Well, thank you. It's great to be here, and great to see all the activity that's an interest that's going on in this direction. So I'll give you an update on constructing local bulk observables. This is work in progress with Gilad Lifshitz, and there's been related works by many other authors. And I guess the title I gave to Steve was an update on constructing these observables. I kind of like the way that Daniel said it yesterday, going from CFT correlators to bulk Lagrangians. And well, I hope to convince you that that's what we're doing. So a little bit of motivation. What I'm going to assume is that we're starting from a CFT that's exactly soluble. At least in principle, we can calculate whatever we want in the CFT to whatever accuracy we need. Of course, that's solving the CFT is an interesting challenge, but that's not the problem I'm going to focus on. I'm going to assume we can solve the CFT exactly. And then what I'd like to do is formulate the problem of reconstructing bulk physics as a kind of a precise mathematical problem, something where you have a well-defined math problem that you just need to solve. So you don't really need to think. You just have to solve this problem. I also hope to convince you that it's actually a problem you can solve systematically in the 1 over n expansion. And so I'll tell you about results in this direction. And then the interesting stuff to speculate is, what happens at finite n if you go beyond the 1 over n expansion? Can you say things about black holes or physics that's not perturbative in 1 over n?
So when you say exactly soluble, you mean just that someone hands you all the correlators or something like that?
Yeah, so in practice, I'd like someone to hand me all of the correlators in the CFT as exact analytic functions.
Great.
So the kind of simplest context to think about these things is ADS2 CFT1. If there's a massless scalar field in the bulk, and that field in the bulk would be dual to a single trace dimension one primary field in the conformal quantum mechanics. Just to get started, let's imagine we look at the CFT at some infinite n limit. In that limit, the CFT only has two-point functions, so in a sense, it's a free CFT. In this limit, what we'd like to be able to do to reconstruct the bulk is just express a free bulk scalar field in terms of the operator in the CFT. And that's a pretty easy problem to solve. It was solved long ago. You want to solve a massless wave equation in the bulk. You want to impose some appropriate boundary conditions that your bulk field falls off like Z times your operator in the CFT as you approach the boundary. Those are the equations you need to solve. Here's the solution. It expresses the bulk field in terms of your boundary operator smeared over some interval in the time direction.
Is this a class for bulk at the moment?
I'm working in the infinite n limit, so it's a classical bulk. It's a free bulk. This is pretty straightforward. This sort of construction generalizes. You can do something similar in higher dimensional ADS. You can do it for fields with spin. You can work it out in other coordinate systems. I think Daniel and Vlad are going to tell us about some of the interesting things that happen when you think about reconstructing bulk physics using other coordinate patches.
So, What about the question of gauge choices in the bulk for fields with spin? I mean, the gravitational and photon fields.
That's right. So if you want to play this game with for fields with spin, then the simplest thing to do is to fix a gauge in the bulk. So if you want to reconstruct a bulk gauge field from a current in the CFT, the simplest gauge choice is to set the Z component of the gauge field to zero. So you reconstruct your bulk gauge field in something like
that. Is that a unitary gauge in the bulk field theory?
It's like axial gauge.
It's essentially axial gauge.
So it's a unitary.
It's a unitary. You only have physical degrees of freedom
in the bulk. You only have physical degrees of freedom on the boundary.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. And there's a similar gauge choice for the metric where you set the HZZ and HZU components of the metric to zero.
But then the question arises in axial gauges in the bulk. We don't have local fields. Right, because there are non-local interactions.
Yeah, there are. Bulk fields, if you like, have Wilson line tails that extend off to the boundary in the z direction.
Right.
So there are non-local commutators. That all works out very neatly. There's a nice story. So the story that I'll tell you today is about trying to enforce bulk microcausality. And I'll show you how you do that mostly for scalar fields. When you're dealing with fields with spin, it turns out the Ward identities in the CFT, those restrict CFT correlators in exactly such a way that they're an obstruction to enforcing bulk microcausality. And you get exactly the non-local commutators that you'd expect from the bulk Gauss constraints. So there's kind of a neat story how that works out. Story for another day, though.
Okay. I'll say a little about it, probably.
But that should presumably infect, at higher orders, infect the scalar fields as well, right? Because they interact with the gravitational.
Yeah, it does. That's
right. Okay. All right. Have you kept up with that? Thank you.
So what about interactions? Various approaches for including interactions have been discussed. Those are two of the references. And the approach that I want to focus on today is one where you take bulk locality bulk microcausality as your guiding principle. So what's the idea there? We're going to start from a correlation function in the CFT. So this is some CFT three-point function. Let's imagine that we apply one of these smearing kernels to the first operator in this correlator. So that should turn it into a field somewhere in the bulk. So now we've got a mixed correlator with one bulk field and two operators on the boundary.
You're now at finite end?
Let's see. So if I was doing this in the 1 over n expansion, this three-point correlator would be order 1 over n. So yeah, I have gone to a subleading order in the 1 over n expansion. The three-point correlator, its form is fixed by conformal invariance. You also know these smearing kernels explicitly, so you can just do this integral. You get an answer that depends on, it's convenient to work in terms of this variable chi. So this is it's an ADS invariant cross ratio that depends on one bulk point and two boundary points. So chi vanishes if your bulk point is light-like separated from the second boundary point, It also vanishes if your bulk point is like separated from the third boundary point, and it diverges when the two boundary points are light-like separated. But if these three points are all at space-like separation, then all of these factors are positive. So chi is positive at space-like separation, and that will be important in a minute. So you go ahead and calculate what you get for this mixed bulk boundary correlator. You find that it's given by a hypergeometric function. And I should say this is a result that's true in general dimensional ADS, and also for scalar fields of arbitrary dimension.
By the way, I guess at this point, K is the thing that's constructed from the free Green's function, space-like Green's function.
That's right.
So this is a function of x. Once you hit it on the three-point function, is non-normalizable, I guess.
No, K constructs normalizable fields in the bulk.
Only if it hits bulk fields that satisfy, say, the free equation of motion.
Let's see, it's hitting the boundary generic,
well, if it acts on a generic function on the boundary, then it constructs non-normalizable things. That's just, you can see that directly from the form of K if you look at the explicit formula.
No, I don't think so. I mean, so here's an explicit expression for K. And if I send Z to 0, if I go to the boundary, then...
This is in 1 plus 1, isn't that? Is that non...
It doesn't look too different, I think, in higher dimensions.
Yeah, no, again, if you look it up in your, even the formulas, when you worked out the form of it in global ADS as a function of x, I'm pretty certain it's non-normalized.
It's secretly not there. It's because in the definition in terms of the mode sum, it's normalizable, but then you use this freedom of adding things that integrate to 0 against O, and the part that integrates to 0 against O has a non-normalizable piece, but it doesn't contribute to the integral.
That's when O satisfies the free equation of motion or the general O?
When O has 48 components that only come from the free solutions in the bulk, those integers integrate to 0.
Yes.
Steve's comment is that if you apply that thing where you've added the extra terms to make it a space-like support, and you integrate against something which has extra 48 components because, for example, it is the full interacting O from the CFT,
right,
those extra pieces won't give 0, and there can be non-normalized
interactions. That's true, but then it's subleading in the interactions, right? So it's canceled by the next door.
Also true.
Yeah, you can try to expand a little bit, but still, you have the non-normalized interaction.
Yeah, so actually, so... I guess I kind of sidestepped those issues. Gilad and I like these smearing functions that have support on the complexified boundary. And then it's just built into the smearing function. It doesn't matter what you integrate against. You get normalizable fall off.
But part of the symptoms directed at
it. To be fair, you know what my comment's going to be. Once you complexify the boundary, you've limited your set of boundary data to analytic data. And that's a very small set of data. So I don't want to belabor this point, but this is an open issue to some extent.
So I guess that's true. I am assuming things are analytic on the boundary, but CFT correlators are analytic where I need them to be. So in that sense, I can get away with this. So you get this expression from doing the smearing integral, and you might think that something should go wrong here, because by construction, K satisfies a free wave equation in the bulk. So this correlator is going to satisfy a free wave equation. But this is an interacting theory, so we shouldn't have things that satisfy free wave equations. So something must go wrong here. And indeed it does. The problem is this hypergeometric function has a branch point at chi equal to 1. So that's space-like separation. Since there's a non-analyticity at space-like separation, it means this bulk field won't commute with these boundary operators, even though they're space-like separated. The discontinuity across the branch cut will give you a non-vanishing commutator. So that's what goes wrong. We've constructed a free field in the bulk, but it doesn't respect locality. So what to do about that? Well, I think there's really kind of only one thing you could imagine doing. You have to redefine what you mean by a bulk field. So you say the bulk field kind of leading order is given by smearing an operator in the CFT. But then if you want to take interactions into account, you need to add a sum that, in principle, runs over all other operators in the CFT. So these are these operators on. You smear each one of them appropriately to whatever its dimension is. There's some arbitrary coefficient in front. And you sum over all of these operators.
Let me rephrase the question I raised on Monday. And that is, to what extent this is a systematic expansion in a small parameter? And the reason I raise that question is because of what we just said. So the integral of k against O is non-normalizable, so it gets arbitrarily big as you go out to the boundary. It's a big thing. Phi itself on the left-hand side should be normalizable, so it's small in that limit. So you have small is equal to big minus big, and the question is, do you really have a sensible expansion in a small parameter? How do you organize the expansion?
Yeah, I do. Like I said, I avoid all of that. Phi is normalizable.
Right.
I use these smearing functions on the complex boundary, so integral KO is normalizable. Well, and as you'll see explicitly, these are higher dimension operators. This correction we're adding actually falls off faster near the boundary than the leading piece.
You could also just choose to use the original smearing function, which is normalizable.
No, that's what we just settled. If
you integrate, you could choose to do it. He didn't, but you could.
The original, as Dan means, it means not the one with just space-like support,
yeah, no,
but
the one
which is defined by a Fourier transform over the entire boundary.
That's correct. Yes.
That's something
different. You need
that's
to,
doing
yeah.
something different. It was, well,
that
yeah, I'm not sure what
it's defined
what
by a mode function.
Do you have to enter it by going to the complexified boundary? I mean, could you say in particular you have these very explicit smearing functions in the Poincaré patch? For example, and so that K could go over the entire boundary of the Poincaré patch.
Right, and those are just normalizable.
Yeah, so you could work with smearing functions that have support on the entire Poincaré patch. I guess you could do that. Probably one could reach the same conclusions that way. These complexified smearing functions actually are kind of nice because if you actually want to do this calculation, what does the smearing function do to a three-point correlator? So the way we set things up on the complexified boundary, you can do this calculation because what you do, you go to a place where the support of the three operators is space-like separated, and then the CFT correlator is some nice analytic function. You can do the integral with no problem. You get this hypergeometric function. If I used a smearing function that had support on the entire Poincaré patch, I'd have kind of unpleasant overlapping operators in the CFT. Exactly sure how I do that calculation. Maybe there's a way of doing it if you work hard enough, but I've never really tried.
So the way you know how to do it is with the complexified boundary, and if you don't want to do that for whatever concerns, then it's not clear quite how to organize it as a systematic intervention.
No,
I think it's fine. You can just use the good one. Do what he said. Use the Planck race marrying function. It's manifestly normalizable, and then just use the Hummes expansion to generate the collections.
But did you say you were concerned about what the integrals do as O2 approaches O3, as the operators approach each other? Was that the last thing you said? You said there was a concern about.
Oh, so since these complexified smearing functions have compact support of the boundary, mm-hmm. I can go to I can put my operators where the support of these three things is at space-like separation.
Yeah.
And then it's a nice, well-defined integral.
Okay, but I'm not sure that's ever a problem in the following sense. So what you have in there is okay. You end up with, although O2 and O3 are time ordered, the actual products on the boundary are Whiteman functions. They're not time-ordered. And I think those are good as distributions. They're integrable against a smooth function. Yeah. So there actually is no potential for a divergence from collision of operators.
Like they're integrable against things that are not in fact smooth, but are singular in just the right way. And the smearing functions are just the same.
Okay.
Maybe that should work. So we have this result from the lowest order calculation that violates locality in the bulk. We want to add this tower of higher dimension operators. And so now it's a math problem. Is there a way to choose the coefficients in this expansion that will restore locality in the bulk? And I claim there is, that as long as you work in the 1 over n expansion, order by order in 1 over n, you can fix these coefficients to achieve bulk locality. So just as a simple example, I guess I'll return to ADS2 CFT1 with dimension 1 operators. So there's an operator in the CFT. It's a single trace primary operator. And if I want to work to order 1 over n, what are the higher dimension operators I need to consider? These ONs, they'll be double trace operators built from two factors of O plus qn derivative operators. So this is an operator that has dimension 2 plus 2n. And then let's start calculating commutators. So I can take my single trace operator. I smear it into the bulk. I take a commutator with an operator on the boundary. And I put that commutator inside a three-point function with some other operator on the boundary. So this is basically the three-point, the bulk boundary mixed three-point function I wrote down earlier. For ADS2 and dimension 1 operators, that turns out to be some Legendre function of square root 1 minus chi. So that's the commutator that you pick up from just the single trace operator. And it's non-analytic when chi goes to 1. You've got this square root singularity. You've also got all of these higher dimension operators, these ONs, that are double trace. You do the same calculation with them. Take the commutator inside a three-point function. It turns out that commutator is given by Legendre polynomials of order 2n plus 1. So these guys also have square root singularities as chi goes to 1. So now the mathematical question is, can you superimpose these higher dimension operators in order to cancel the singularity we got from the single trace guy? There's a very nice formula that the Q0 Legendre function is given by a sum of all the odd Legendre polynomials. So the coefficients in this sum, these are basically the coefficients an that you need to stick in that will let you cancel the non-locality of lowest order against all of these double trace operators. So there are there are normalization coefficients that you need to keep track of as you go through all of this. But you would do that, and you can do that and keep track of all of the normalizations. And you can get explicit expressions for these AN coefficients, the AN coefficients that you
need. So sorry, do you have in mind a kind of probe sector that's internally consistent by itself? The cancellation has to work within the sector, this O and its derivative, is that? As opposed to a couple of other fields, maybe.
So what I'm doing here, I'm starting from a particular three-point function in the CFT, and I'm trying to lift one of those operators to be a local field in the bulk. So I'm doing this construction for one particular three-point function. And that's one of the, open questions. Can you make this work for all three-point functions simultaneously? Or what's kind of the same thing? Can you make it work in a four-point function? So there is more work to be done in that direction.
Maybe related, I mean, this will work for any CFT with a large N expansion. Vector-like, say, garbage, I mean.
No, actually.
No, what goes wrong? Right, but this is where's the?
Well, for example, those O that you need to have the only light operators, right? So in general,
where's that?
So he's assuming that those O's are multi-trace operators whose dimensions are just integers times the dimension of this single trace one, and if there were other operators around, they would mix in the OPE, and so the way what you need is the three-point functions in the CFT to be consistent with what you get from Feynman diagrams in the bulk. And that won't be true if there are other low dimension operators sitting around. Like if you have like a dimension 10 operator that doesn't, you know, come from some stringy.
So this particular criterion you're saying would be satisfied because you just showed it explicitly.
Yeah, we're
satisfied. However, that's not enough.
Well, in this model, he assumed that he's making assumptions about the OPE, right? Like he said the three-point function is something in the CFT.
So are we talking about the higher point function? I mean,
this is
my function.
Yeah, this is only 4-point. Right?
I mean, talking about the 4-point.
Yeah, but this 3-point function argument depends on nothing.
But the 4-point
will show up in the 4-point.
Yeah, because these other operators will show up in the open.
Yeah, but that's the test.
That's right. At the level of 3-point functions, you need the 1 over n counting, but that's pretty much it.
Yeah, so this is almost kinematic. This is not.
You do need large n.
Right, but that's very mild.
Yeah.
So a couple of things I'm not understanding about this. So far as I can see, you just showed us commutation between this thing and boundary operators, right? But in a local theory, the different bulk fields and space-like separated bulk points would also have zero commutation. I'm just asking, that's an additional thing that one has to build in, or what is?
Yeah, that's true. I think, let's see. So I think checking locality with all of your boundary operators is probably enough to guarantee that you've got locality even for two points in the bulk.
I don't immediately see that argument. I'd like to see it if everybody understands that it's true.
I don't want to derail the talk, but I think it's
true. Because
you can solve the equations of motion in,
right? Sorry?
You assume that the boundary correlators are given by Feynman-Witten diagrams in some local theory. And then if that's true, then if you solve the operator equations of motion in, you know that the local theory operators just are constructed in the same way, and you know that those commute, so these will too.
That's true, but that's an ingredient that I'm trying to avoid using in this construction.
I understand.
But I think this should be sufficient, but that would be a good thing.
When you say soluble in 1 over n expansion, you mean leading order in 1 over n expansion, right?
The work that we've done is just
leading order.
But we just had a discussion a little while ago in which you said you expect the fields to be non-local in the gauge that you've chosen in the bulk.
He means you got the right commutators, not that the commutators are zero.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's right.
Going back to the previous question, which is the student locality at order 1 over n. Now, if you go to at 1 over n squared, then maybe we can resolve, maybe we can make the 4-point correlator local. But there will be a loop contribution from the 2-point function as well, which would be 1 by n squared. Then how do we know that we'll be able to cancel both the 4-point contribution and the 2-point loop contribution?
So that's a good question. I think that's one of the kind of open issues that when you go to order 1 over n squared, as you said, on the bulk side, there'll be loop diagrams. And it's an interesting question how this procedure of bulk reconstruction, how it handles those loop diagrams. On the bulk, you kind of know what to do. You know there's a you have to renormalize. How does that show up in the CFT? Pieces of it you understand. Operators in the CFT should acquire anomalous dimensions. So you should, I think you do need to go back and correct the dimensions of your operators order by order as you work in one other end. I think it's an interesting question how you actually do all of that in practice.
To what extent do people attack the 4-point function? What's the status? Is that not been looked at at all?
Hasn't really been done.
There are calculations of 4-point functions from Feynman Witten diagram.
Yeah.
And they show the renormalization effect you just talked about of the double trace operators, right? There are logs in those correlators. That explain correspond to the renormalization of the double trace operator.
No, but I'm thinking about this program for.
No, this program.
For
yeah, this program hasn't gotten to order 1 over n squared.
Yeah.
Okay. So there are so let's see. Well, okay, good. So in this way, we're able to build a field in the bulk that's local to order 1 over n. Still not quite satisfying, because we'd like to say a little bit more. We'd like to say, for example, what are the bulk equations of motion? And the concern is we've developed this expression where our field that's now local in the bulk is a smeared operator plus an infinite sum of smeared double trace operators. And that's not the way that we're used to thinking about a field from the bulk point of view. So we'd like to say, for example, what kind of equation of motion does this object satisfy? And it turns out it's not too difficult to work it out. So here are the steps. Let's take this expression for our bulk field. And this was a massless field in the bulk. So let's act with the massless wave operator. So on the left-hand side, we get box of phi. On the right-hand side, the first term in this expansion, k there, by construction, satisfies the massless wave equation. So box will kill that guy. All of the higher dimension operators are smeared in the way appropriate to their mass. So these satisfy the free wave equation for a field of mass appropriate to their dimension. So when you act with box, box on this just gives you a factor of the mass squared for that, whatever the dimension of that operator is. So you get a sum, these coefficients that we've determined,
the mass squared corresponding to all of these different operators times the smeared operators. So still, from the bulk point of view, this kind of sum is not not a very familiar looking object. We'd like to identify what it is in terms of bulk quantities. Here's a way to do that. Let's take this quantity on the right-hand side. It's a CFT operator. Well, it's an infinite sum of CFT operators. Let's stick it into a CFT correlator with two other operators. So what you get is basically an infinite sum of mixed bulk boundary correlators. It's that same hypergeometric function I wrote down earlier. You need to do the sum on n. You do that, and you get a pretty simple expression. And what you get, it factorizes. And each of these factors is actually a bulk boundary two-point correlator. This first factor is the bulk boundary correlator for a bulk point with a boundary point x2. This other one is the correlator for a bulk point with a boundary point x3. So, in fact, you can identify from the bulk point of view what this right-hand side is. It's just the square of your bulk field. So you just stick phi squared in here, you get a product of two bulk boundary correlators.
Did you say you have a tree-level
correction to the
mass of the field?
No. So I've identified this is going to be the equation of motion for a bulk field.
Right. So it has a mass. Oh, sorry, that's a cubic term. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So box phi
goes like phi squared. Mm-hmm. We have a phi cubed field. Yeah,
and again, if you keep track of normalizations, starting from the CFT three-point correlator, you can figure out what the phi cube coupling in the bulk is. Yeah.
Sorry, I'm confused about something very basic. Conceptually, all you have so far used for the sort of reconstruction was just the bulk geometry. But where is the input that would? That gives you the information to extract the dynamics?
So I did start with a CFT three-point correlator, and that encodes information about the dynamics. So that's where it came in.
Well, a related question, the input from the bulk is basically the smearing function. That's the thing that depends. That's the place where you bring in bulk data in a sense.
Or at least,
no, he's reconstructing that. So he's not starting with that. But then
the smearing function is just solving equations from the Lagrangian, so it's not.
So they do. The
smearing function is group theory, right? It's realizing.
Yes, that's right.
That's good. Yeah.
Where does the particular CFT
enter? So the particular CFT, the dynamics come from the three-point correlator in the CFT, and that's fixed by conformal invariance up to an overall coefficient.
Are you saying that any CFT gives at that order, or even a full theory? Are the coefficients different?
The coefficient in the CFT three-point correlator would determine the coefficient of the bulk phi cube coupling.
Is it really just local like that? It isn't.
In the bulk, we recovered a local bulk interaction.
To this order in 1/n.
It's not unique bulk
Lagrangian that would give this? Because you could make a perturbative field your definition of phi.
Let's see.
Like phi plus g phi to the fourth.
Yeah.
Some theory in the book for which, miraculously, you only get the three-point function of this order. So there's some, this is like trying to reconstruct a Lagrangian from the S matrix.
Yeah, so maybe...
what you're giving is sort of the simplest approach. I'm not saying it's not a good one.
Okay, let's see. Well, let me skip ahead then.
Having written down that equation...
Oh, sorry.
And having solved it in some way with some given ans and ons, either it satisfies that bulk equation of motion or it doesn't, and there's no more opportunity for fuel with two definitions.
I'm saying there's another bulk equation of motion that could yield the same three foot functions.
That will be true,
yeah,
okay. but that's saying that there's the solution he wrote down on the top line is actually not needed.
Correct. Good. You're right.
One way to see that non-uniqueness is actually you can instead of using local single double trace operators, you can use bilocal fields, bilocal products of single trace operators. So you can do a double integral instead of a single integral. And that's, in fact, from the equation of motion that you're getting at the end, you can see that you must be able to write it like that. Is there any advantage to starting with that assumption and enforce Michael's locality on the previous slide, that say we write down, instead of this KNON, simply write down some double integral bilocal field.
So if you solve the bulk equations of motion perturbatively, that's kind of guaranteed to give you bulk locality. And it naturally leads to these expressions where, at order 1 over n, you add bilocal corrections to your field.
I want to say, let's start with a bilocal assumption, but not assuming a local equation of motion at the moment, but derive it using the same methods. I think it would succeed.
Yeah, probably. You probably could start with some bilocal onsots and...
Because your double trace operator is simply a Taylor expansion.
Yeah, that's right.
So it's the same amount of information put in.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, it'd be interesting to see if you could start with a bilocal onsots. Maybe it's easier. There have been some questions, and this is something that Tom Banks raised as an issue a while ago. You could object to this on the grounds that there must be some ambiguities in this reconstruction of a bulk theory. And I think you can see this both from the bulk side and from the CFT side. So on the bulk side, you're free to take some bulk theory and make local field redefinitions in the bulk. That will change the Lagrangian, change the equations of motion, but it really leaves the theory invariant. In flat space, it would leave the S matrix invariant. In ADS-CFT, I think the statement would be that the CFT correlators that you extract from that theory would be the same. So we have that kind of ambiguity about the bulk theory coming from the bulk side. What I'm going to claim is that we actually have exactly the same ambiguity on the CFT side. Because we chose all of these coefficients in front of higher dimension operators in order to cancel some unwanted non-analyticity that spoiled locality. But that procedure isn't unique, because on the CFT side, I'm always free to add a tower of higher dimension operators that don't spoil the analyticity properties, so that things still commute at space-like separation. And so what I'm claiming, I guess, is that these two ambiguities are in one-to-one correspondence. And I think it's pretty clear, because if you if you start on the bulk side, so imagine you have some local field in the bulk. If you make a field redefinition like phi goes to phi plus phi squared, since what you've added to your bulk field is a local operator, such an addition to your bulk field will commute at space-like separation, say, with boundary operators. So this such an addition won't spoil the analyticity properties that we wanted. Or kind of conversely, if you come up with some combination of CFT operators that you can add that don't spoil analyticity, kind of by construction, such a combination is acts like a local thing in the bulk. It commutes at space-like separation. You should be able to think of it as a local field redefinition in the bulk. So I claim that all works out. The ambiguities that are associated with field redefinitions match the ambiguities that you encounter in trying to reconstruct a local field in the bulk. Just as an example of the sort of game you can play, if you start with this would be the equation of motion for a phi cubed theory in the bulk, and you make a local field redefinition, it turns it into a theory that has a different phi cubed coupling, but also has a derivative coupling. And then this has kind of been shown in the literature. If you take a theory like this in the bulk, and you calculate Feynman-Witten diagrams and take them to the boundary, they give exactly the same boundary three-point functions that you'd get starting from your original theory. So I think that's a consistent story. There are some generalizations that maybe I'll mention. Most of the formulas that I've talked about are for ADS2, but you can play the same sort of game for scalar theories in higher dimensional ADS, scalar fields with arbitrary masses. We've also considered scalar fields in the bulk that are coupled to gauge fields, coupled to a conserved current on the boundary. In that case, you can play the same game. You start with the three-point function between two scalar operators and a conserved current on the boundary. You try to lift one of these scalar operators to a local field in the bulk. You can do it by adding higher dimension operators. You work out what the equations of motion have to be. And you get the right coupling between your bulk scalar field and the gauge field. It also works for a scalar field coupled to gravity. Then you start from the correlation function with a stress tensor, so OOT. Promote the one of the scalar operators to a field in the bulk. And you recover the right coupling to the bulk metric perturbation. So I guess those are the generalizations that we've explored. There are some things which...
Going back to that, so you're reconstructing the bulk fields, not the dressed bulk fields. Or what are you doing?
No, they will be the dress.
These are the dress.
Oh, they are. It is with the with the dress.
Yeah.
Right. They don't
So, for example, to put this scalar field in the bulk, you need to add higher dimension operators, which are double trace, and they're built from the scalar field plus a stress tensor. So it's exactly the gravitational dressing that comes in. Yeah.
So. Why not apply this in practice to theories which have Vassiliev in the bulk, and then work out 1 over n, what the action is in the equations of motion?
I think that'd be, that's an interesting project.
Is it
you think it, so you think there's an obstacle or at least difficulty of going beyond, I mean, you did spin one, spin two, what happens at spin three?
I don't know. We haven't tried to do spin three.
So we don't expect that to be local.
That's one of the challenges that I'm not sure what sort of locality properties you'd want to enforce on a higher spin theory.
But also here to higher order, you don't have exact micro locality, right?
Yeah, but that's a lot of
gauges. Well,
yeah. So.
Comprehensible by mortals, right?
Yeah. So what? What you do, so for example, to make this charged scalar field, since it's charged, it's not really local in the bulk. It has this Wilson line tail that goes off to infinity. So what helps is the fact that the scalar field isn't local with respect to the electric field in the z direction, but it is local with respect to f mu nu with indices tangent to the boundary. So that's actually the condition that we impose. So you make it local with respect to f mu nu tangent to the boundary. That's enough to fix the coefficients. And then you go and check what's the commutator with f mu z, and it comes out to be exactly what it should be by the Gauss constraint.
I see. So you actually think there will be enough real locality constraints where I don't have to sort of know the bulk Lagrangian and what the non-locality looks like in order to fix all of these things, and then the non-localities will just come out. That's the claim.
I hope so. That works for E&M. For gravity, it's a little shakier. To this order in 1 over n, you found some components of the Weyl tensor that respect locality. And
when you found the correct non-zero commutators.
That
did work to that order. That's impressive.
And it's all... it all works very nicely. So for these charged scalar fields, the higher dimension operators that you add, they're scalar operators, but they're actually not primary fields. And what that means is the field in the bulk that you build, it doesn't quite transform like a scalar under ABS isometries. But that's also exactly what you expect, because if you act with an ADS isometry, it moves the Wilson line, and then you need a compensating gauge transformation to put the Wilson line back in the z direction. So the field has an anomalous phase under isometries, which is exactly the fact that the corrections you add aren't primary.
I'm confused about this Wilson line. So this phi is some local bulk field. And then you say, well, you have to obey Gauss's law, so you have to add some Wilson line. Isn't it actually a physics choice? You know, whether I add a somewhat spherical symmetric field or... All right, so then you're making some particular choice of addressing there?
Yeah.
Which is a single Wilson line that's still
yeah.
not...
Yeah, that's like the axial gauge condition.
Yeah,
it's... Well, if it's a gauge condition, then it's not physics.
It corresponds to making a physical choice of Wilson line. It's a one-to-one correspondence with making that gauge.
But when I insert a charged particle at a point, I can choose various different ways of satisfying Gauss's.
Yeah, that corresponds to making
operators.
Different
gauge choices. Those would be different operators.
Those are different physical operators.
Exactly. Yeah. They're different physical operators that are not related by gauge choice.
Yes, that's right.
Absolutely
okay. So here, you picked one which in axial gauge looks simple.
Okay.
But they're all such that they would give the same scattering matrix.
Yeah. And if you computed a gauge invariant operator, the regressions would cancel. Right? If you computed phi dagger phi.
Yeah, in electrodynamics.
In electrodynamics. In gravity, it's less clear.
Yeah.
No, actually, I don't think that's true.
Phi dagger phi is the same as the interesting one.
The same point.
Of course,
the same point.
Yeah, but in a general scattering application, I think it depends on which.
No, I mean the local operator, phi dagger phi.
Yeah.
You can choose, for example, in non-Abelian gauge theory, choose axial gauges in different directions, choose to use the physical A components in those different gauges as interpolating fields. You'll die before you actually compute all the Feynman diagrams. But you will find the same answer no matter which gauge you chose.
Okay. Related to this, and actually this connects to the stuff Will and I have been doing. If you create phi, you know, with the Wilson line that goes off to infinity in the z direction, so that actually, that is a physical choice, a physical field configuration. And in fact, if you evolve it, what happens is it basically radiates away. So you get radiation at infinity from the, because the optimal field configuration is not to be all, have the flux lines confined all going along a small tube in the z direction. They want to spread out and be the Coulomb field. And in the process, you get radiation at infinity. So in fact, if you use different operators, I think you'll get different.
Phi dagger phi is a Gaussian invariant local operator.
I'm not saying compute phi dagger if you have a 4-point function of the phi's at different points. Say if you're computing an S matrix.
You'll get different answers, but if you go and compute the S matrix, you'll get the same answer. You take the axial gauge. I didn't tell you which direction to take the axial gauge in. Let's go compute the S matrix in the axial gauge in the standard model, okay? All the non-Abelian fields are massive. There's a real S matrix, no infrared issues except the usual electrodynamics ones. I'm working in axial gauge. I'll get the same answer for the S matrix no matter what direction I put in. The S matrix will be Lorentz invariant.
It's maybe... just to conclude, a few kind of open issues, open questions, and some of these points have already come up. I think one question is just if you try to push the 1 over n expansion to higher orders. At order 1 over n, we only had 3-point functions, and aside from using 1 over n counting, it seemed this would work in pretty much any CFT. If you try to impose locality at the level of 4-point functions, you might find more constraints. And in particular, you might find that there were constraints on the CFT spectrum that have been discussed in the literature and in Liam's talk. Another issue that one would have to face at order 1 over n squared. At that order, you start seeing bulk loops, bulk renormalization effects. How do those come into this program? How do you take those into account? These questions, I think, are interesting and kind of worth working on. They're the sort of questions that, with some effort, I think one can kind of plow through this stuff. But in a way, the kind of bigger prize is trying to understand what happens at finite n. And there's been some speculation about this in the literature, some work that I did with Gilad, Papadimos and Raju have talked about these things, and also Steve has some related speculation. I think most likely, at finite n, this program actually just crashes. That there's no way to actually build local bulk fields at finite n. And so I think if you start with a finite n CFT
and have kind of real quantum gravity in the bulk with finite Planck length, I think you're going, well, you could still define fields in the bulk, but I think you're going to have to live with non-local commutators that probably are of order e to the minus n squared.
What specifically crashes, say if n is huge but finite, what specifically are you saying crashes what you've done so far? Has you seen the crash?
Yeah, so this business that if we started with a single trace operator, we could make it local by adding all of these double trace operators with the right coefficients. So to get those coefficients, we did need to use large n counting. We calculated all of the correlation functions using the 1 over n expansion. At finite n...
Well, so I'm arguing against what I was saying earlier. No, I'm just trying to understand how to look at it. But, okay, so maybe it doesn't converge, but you could at least develop formally an expansion in 1 over n.
Well, they stop, the operators stop being independent, though, right? Once you have, like, you know, order n of... you don't get to change their coefficients independently.
Yeah, so at some point the expansion goes bad, but it could be like QED or something where we have a good expansion, you know, that works out to some number of orders.
Yeah. And that's why he wrote e to the minus n squared.
Yeah.
Okay. It might be some kind of asymptotic expansion, and you'd be left with the effects of order e to the minus n squared.
What would that mean in terms of measurable non-locality? Like if we tried to tell our experimental friends, if you push down to 10 to the minus 18 meters, if you just push down to 10 to the minus 23, how would we?
Well, so this would be an effect that's non-perturbative in Newton's constant. So it'd be non-perturbative in the Planck length.
And in the EDS scale. I mean, if you thought about this in a Minkowski space limit, they might be zero. If you thought about this in a limit where you turned off the cosmological constant, that might just be zero. It might be even like something. At the level what's written here.
The fact that coupling is the wavelength we're considering in black
units. Yeah. You think that n is something which is more.
Yeah, it's the wavelength we're considering divided by the time.
Yeah. I mean, that's a reasonable guess, but is that something that comes out of this calculation in some clear way?
Well, it's the effective coupling in gravity, so we're assuming that.
I'm sympathetic to that idea.
I'm confused on many levels by this estimate of how big the commutators should be.
Yeah.
So this 1 over n expansion is a weak coupling string expansion. That's right. How we think about it. So there are operators whose dimension scales to infinity with n, okay, whose contribution comes in at the string scale, and those should violate locality because ordinary perturbative string theory doesn't have a local field expansion. And then if we're talking about non-perturbative effects, Steve argued it. 1,000 years ago, that there are e to the minus n.
But also from the bulk perspective,
it would be tiny though. You know, bulk are small. I mean, maybe those aren't the big non-locality things.
But there's some violation of locality. Add order, at least. But just perturbative string effects should violate.
Well, presumably you run into trouble on the, I guess your second line is. I mean, if you have a big string length, then you go home. So you want to push the string length to be of order the Planck length to be happy.
But then you're not doing the 1 over n.
Well, you do whatever, flat space.
All of this stuff was standard 1 over n counting. It was not the low energy expansion, right? This was sort of saying, I have a dimensionless parameter for arbitrary momentum, okay? And I'm expanding, he hasn't talked about the alpha prime expansion here,
But treating the 1 over n expansion for the g string expansion.
I think he's in the flat space.
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
His lambda is of order of n over lambda is fixed, right?
That's the way you cure the third line.
Yeah.
You do that. So you find you do that when you run into that trouble. And then you do that. And then you still probably have g to the minus Planck length. Whatever the suppression of making a black hole.
That's m squared.
No, but again,
let's call it L Planck.
Well, I think from the bulk point of view, you expect to have big effects, you know, when you, say, make a bulk black hole, say, in a high energy collision, and that's not e to the minus n squared, I don't think. It's not suppressed. It's an order one effect when you collide enough energy in a small enough region.
Yeah, but he's not doing that. He's doing low energy.
No, well, okay, yeah. So if you consider these things with sufficiently high
energy.
These are
like shell black holes or something.
Yeah, but but what about the onshell ones? You would have a similar breakdown of the.
Do you have another transparency?
This is it, actually. I think actually the place where our estimate for these commutators is maybe best understood is actually by trying to look at what happens if you try to reconstruct local fields in a black hole background. And then we know something about finite end correlators in a thermal CFT. And we can translate that into a statement about these commutators. And then the suppression factor is e to the minus entropy of the black hole. So that's the setup where I think they're best understood or under the most control.
Dan, that's for an expectation value of a commutator in a thermal state at high temperature?
That's right.
Is there any chance that those non-local effects could be big enough to explain the rising problem without inflation?
Well, I don't know. It's true. You might think non-local effects should be there in cosmology, and you know what kind of effects they might have.
If you didn't believe in an early phase of accelerated expansion, you would say we're already going to see horizon correlators. If you had a fundamental theory that produced them, at least at the right scale, I don't know whether it does or not. Is there any chance to combine?
I don't know. I don't know. It would be interesting to see how these ideas play out in a cosmological setting.
So can I answer a question about the black hole story? The standard understanding in the CFT of the black hole, the Hawking phase transition, involves all of these states which have very high dimension. They have dimensions of order n squared and this very, very dense spectrum and so on. And to what extent, I mean, those states don't satisfy large n counting rules at all, but you're somehow saying that despite that, you would expect in that background to be able to have local fields that satisfy the usual?
So this would be trying to carry out the construction perturbatively around a black hole background. So you take a black hole background and then try to construct perturbative fields around that background instead of around MDAS.
If we compute Euclidean correlators on at finite temperature, I guess we expect that the correlators factorize in some limit, at least.
So
we can look at correlators in the thermal trace, so Euclidean correlators at finite temperature, and then I guess we expect that they factorize in a particular limit when the separations are not very large. And then we know that typical microstates, correlators of typical microstates would be close to correlators on the thermal ensemble. And this implies that the correlators should approximately factorize even in around a pure state, a typical pure state, at least when the separations are not very large.
It seems to me that this is the wrong question, as finite again. I mean, everyone's still talking about fields on some fixed space-time background. Right? But finite n is real quantum gravity, and the metric is fluctuating. There's some wave function superposition of metrics. And so why are we talking about whether operators commute different space like separation?
There's a regime, even at finite n, you know, in the real world, that's approximately true, right? In our description of the field theory of the real world, there are regimes where you have small gravitational effects and regimes where you have big ones. With finite gravitational coupling.
This is perturbative canonical gravity, so the metric is fluctuating perturbatively.
It's not perturbative at finite n. No.
Well, at large, but finite n, it's a not bad approximation to do a perturbation theory.
Exactly.
This n probably is a lot bigger than 1/100, you know, 137.
Yeah, it's like doing perturbative QED. Exactly.
So I think what Gary is saying is that if we are looking at this accuracy, we have a gravitational instant and then we bounce these two points just next to each other.
Absolutely.
For example.
Yeah, especially that.
No, so the claim is you just don't believe anything at that size. Right?
That's correct. Yeah, that's a better way of asking the question. Yeah. And it's not just that it's that level of precision you'll never get.
Right. That's true. Well, let's see. So working from the CFT side, you can try to construct local fields in the bulk and ask, you know, to what accuracy are you able to carry that out? And I think it breaks down, by this order. And then you could also try to understand this from the bulk. Is there some non-perturbative bulk gravitational physics, which likewise violates locality. There are all sorts of bulk effects that you could speculate about. So maybe it's too much to hope that there'll be any kind of matching.
Put differently, there are different ways to try to reconstruct, bulk gravity. What is our target? One target is a set of observables with some algebra that they obey, and it may not look, like exactly the algebra of local field operators. You wouldn't expect it to, in fact. Nonetheless, you could try to identify these operators in my there's the size of the corrections to what look like the local relations.
So I have a very basic conclusion that's related to what Gary just asked. Suppose you're trying to run this program for bulk gravity in stress sensor. You talked about field redefinitions. So I could imagine doing field redefinitions to the gravity, to the bulk metric. So when I try to look for locality with respect to what metric am I supposed to look for locality?
Let's see.
You're always doing perturbation theory.
So is that the out? That is a well-defined background light cone that sure. Defines everything for me?
Yeah. In these 1/n expansion stories, for sure, once you start talking about what happens at finite n, then I think you guys all disagree with each other, and I disagree with all of you.
Sadly, the nature of this field.
Thanks very much.